Blog Talk Radio.
This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview. I've enjoyed the illustrations of Drew Friedman for many, many years. He has going for him what many artists can only dream of, a distinctive style and, if you will, a voice that sets his work apart. Depending upon your age and interest, you've no doubt seen Friedman's work somewhere, including the National Lampoon, Spy, and the New York Observer. When Drew draws a satirical picture, it always screams with attitude. There's no subtlety involved. Drew, thanks for joining us this week.
Thanks, Bob. Nice to be here.
Thanks. Now, your new book is Old Jewish Comedians, so I have to ask you, why old Jewish comedians? Why not capture them in their youth?
There have been other books about Jewish comedians. There's actually a lot of them. But I wanted to sort of bring a different spin into that world and capture sort of a melancholiness about them that you don't really see elsewhere. Also, I enjoy drawing older people because there's more character in the faces, and it's just more interesting for me to draw older people with all those lines. And so that was part of it too. But it's basically the fact that a lot of these guys were forgotten also, and throughout their entire careers, like, basically added up to nothing. Some of them were incredibly famous throughout their careers, but I also drew a lot of people who nobody ever heard of, including Menashe Skolnick, who is the one guy who everybody says, who was he, except people over 50 sort of remember him. But
and who was he? Because you're right. I like to think that I know a lot of these guys, but that name went right by me.
I didn't even know who he was either. I found his photograph in an old player's guide, which was a book of just actors and comedians and who used to advertise in this book called The Player's Guide. I think it still comes out. But his face was in there, and I sort of, we Googled him and got some information. It turns out he was incredibly famous in his day, mainly in the Yiddish theater. But he was a comic actor, and he also turned up on Ed Sullivan, and he was on Broadway into the 1960s. I think he died around 1970. But he was hugely popular, and now he's completely forgotten, except for, my aunt and uncle remember him. My father says, of course I remember him. And usually people over 50 will, like, it'll register, but anybody under 50, they have no idea who he was.
And why just Jews, by the way?
Well, can you think of any non-Jews who were funny? Somebody said, you could do a old Protestant comedian book, and I said, well, that would be a pamphlet, wouldn't it? I can think of a few. Bob Hope was funny, of course, and Charlie Chaplin claimed he was Jewish. I think he was half Jewish, and Jackie Gleason and Lou Costello. There's a handful of them, but across the board, it mainly comes down to Jewish guys. In fact, there's so many that I'm doing a sequel that will be out next year called More Old Jewish Comedians. This book is only 35 pages, so I have to sort of pick and choose my favorites.
Who did you miss in the first book that you'll have in the second book?
Oh, it's a long list. I've already started the book, but my rule is that to qualify as old, you have to be past 70. That was my first rule for the first book, was born before 1930 would make. But I'm sort of breaking that rule with the second book because I'm including Woody Allen in the second book. And he was born in 1936, so he's a little younger.
See, now I went back and looked because I got to the end of the book and I thought, where's Woody? He's got to be close.
Woody Allen, the part of the book is including their real name and then their show business name. So that's basically the text in the book. I didn't include biographies. Leonard Maltin wrote the introduction, and I thought that summed everything up nicely. But Woody Allen's real name was Alan Stewart Konigsberg, and he was born in 1936, and he'll be in the next book. The illustration's already complete.
Nice Jewish boy from Coney Island, isn't he?
I think he's from, I'm not sure exactly. I'm not sure he's from Coney Island. I think he's from, I don't know exactly.
Maybe I'm reaching that point where I'm confusing his life with his movies now.
There was another Jewish comedian born in Coney Island. It's possible it was Sid Caesar. But you know, well, that great scene, of course, in Annie Hall, where they he goes back to his home and that took place in the roller coaster.
Right, like under the roller coaster. Yeah,
which is weirdly ironic that you're mentioning that, because I had relatives who lived in that roller coaster, and that's where we filmed the scenes.
Really?
Yeah, they were like second cousins to my mother, and they had that apartment under the roller coaster. It wasn't the Cyclone, it was the Thunderbolt roller coaster. And we visited them when I was a kid, and it was exactly like Woody Allen portrayed it in the film, where the roller coaster would just, you know, go, you know, it was on, and then the people were sitting in the house and didn't even react to it. They were so used to it. So he captured that beautifully.
Did you, when you started on this, had you done some of these illustrations for something else and adapted them, or did you do this wholly for the book?
Everything was done just for this book.
Okay.
For that square format. This book is 10 by 10. It's a hardcover 10 by 10, and it sort of feels like a children's book. It's like a storybook, but it's 10 by 10 hardcover. There's only 35 pages, but everything was done specifically for the book. I've drawn some of the people before who appear in the book, like Jerry Lewis. I've drawn him a number of times. I've drawn Woody Allen a bunch of times,
mm-hmm.
and some of the other ones, but this was all for this book.
Yeah, I mean, some of these really are obscure. I mean, Mousie Garner and... who's the other one? Al Kelly. I don't know who Al Kelly is.
Yeah, he's pretty much forgotten, too.
He was
in one movie short, but he was a Friars guy. He was in his career with the Friars. He did Double Talk. He was a Double Talk comedian, so mm-hmm. he would, like, come out as, like, an ambassador at a Friars roast and pretend to be, like, from a foreign dignitary, and he would get everything, like, you know, confused in his dialect. His dialect was off, and... It made no sense, but he had, you know, he was funny, but he's completely forgotten also, although he wrote an autobiography that came out in the 60s. But his real name was Abraham Kalish, and he changed it to Al Kelly, which certainly didn't sound Jewish. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, part of this book, I didn't want to, you know, you could sort of say I was outing some of these guys, you know, because they sort of changed their names, and a lot of them wanted to play down their Jewishness, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, the book, again, I wasn't trying to out them, but I want, you know, part of the charm and fun of the book is to have their real name included in there. So I wasn't even sure he was Jewish when I first, you know, because I knew about him. And Al Kelly, I guess he's an Irish guy, but it turns out his name was Abraham Kalish. And Mousie Garner was, he just died recently. He lived into his 90s, but he was a guy who was, he was one of the, well, like, not the Three Stooges, but when the Three Stooges left, Ted Healy, who was he was sort of in charge of them in the 30s. He was the straight man.
Mm.
They were his stooges. But when they quit to go to Columbia Pictures to do their own films, Mousie Garner was part of three guys that Ted Healy hired to be the new stooges.
Oh.
And then, you know, he sort of like existed in show business for half a century, and he wound up in Spike Jonze's band briefly in the 50s, although he couldn't play any instruments, but he looked funny. And that was important. And he just recently died, but there he is.
I love the illustration that opens the book of William Bud Abbott, of course, partner of Lou Costello for so long. One of my great regrets is that late in his life, when I was growing up in New Jersey, he played a gig at a cheesy hotel in East Brunswick, New Jersey, and I couldn't find a way to get there. I think I may have been like 16 or 17. You had to be 18 to get in or some such thing, and I've always remembered that every time I drive by that little dumpy hotel, I think, damn, if only I had gotten to see there. And I think like a year or two later, he was gone.
Oh, I feel your pain.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
I have the same regret about not visiting Larry Fine when he was at the old actor's home in Hollywood at the end of his life in the 70s after he suffered some strokes. But he loved getting visitors.
Mm.
And, you know, kids would fly out from all over the country to visit him. And I never did that. I regretted that. And, he died in the mid-70s. But I did have the opportunity to visit Groucho Marx at his house.
Really?
Because my father was friendly with the woman who lived with Groucho Marx at the time, and she invited us in 1975, when Groucho was 85, to visit his house and have dinner there, and there were other guests there. So we spent the afternoon with Groucho, and that was an incredible, incredible experience. And the thing that I'm still kicking myself about is that we were invited back the next week. Groucho just loved company, loved younger people. When he met us, when we arrived at the house, we came to the door, and Groucho approached us, and he looked at my father and said, It's a pleasure to meet you and your three lovely daughters. Because our hair was a little long at the time. Everything with him was a one-liner. He was just as sharp as ever. He was all slowed down, but he still sang. He still wanted to, you know, be involved in everything. Everybody that came in, he came and greeted them. It was amazing. But everything was a one-liner, and it was just, you know, it was incredible how it came out of him. Like, the other great line I thought was, my brother, we knew Groucho lived in Great Neck, Long Island, where we lived when we were kids in the 60s. So we knew Groucho had a house there before he moved to Hollywood. In Great Neck, there was a movie theater that was still there when we were kids called The Playhouse, and we had always heard it had been an old vaudeville theater. So my brother said, Groucho, do you remember the Playhouse Theater in Great Neck? They had an old organ in the back. And Groucho, without missing a beat, said, I got an old organ myself. So, you know, just like everything, it was incredible. Nonstop. And then he got up and sang for like an hour with I think, Harpo's son playing piano. So it was an incredible experience.
So it's not just a visit, it's entertainment.
Yeah, of course, of course. I mean, just sitting there with him. I got to sit there while he ate his cream chicken at the table, and they, you know, it's just like, just that was enough for me, but you know, there was more to the... So my regret is that we were invited back the next week because Groucho was going to be reunited with Mae West. They hadn't seen each other for 35 years since they were both at Paramount. And we declined the invitation for some reason. I guess we just felt, oh, we had enough Groucho. You know? So I still regret that. And also regret that we didn't take any photographs either. But, you know.
Now, I wanted to ask you about that. I wanted to ask you, I mean, you've got a... for lack of a better term, the double truck in the book of Groucho and Harpo and Chico. Did you meet his brothers as well?
No. Chico died around 19... He died in the early 60s, around 1960, and Zeppo died in 64. So that was,
okay, I didn't realize it had been that long.
Zeppo died... Well, Zeppo lived into the 70s, and so did Gummo, who everybody said was the funniest Marx brother, but, you know, he quit even before they were on Broadway. But Gummo and Zeppo will be in the second book together,
okay,
on one page.
And where did you get the photo references for all these old Jewish comedians? I mean, obviously it's easy to find photos of them in their youth and the height of their popularity, but some of these you wouldn't even recognize.
A lot of the photos are photos I've been clipping over the years. It's always been a hobby of mine to just clip, you know, weird photos and photos of celebrities, and, you know, not just like smiling shots of celebrities staring at the camera, but more, you know, just stranger kind of like shots of them, or even like the size of their faces. And so I had a file. I also have a lot of books with photographs of some of these guys, and their biographies usually have. And then people were sending me stuff. And then, of course, these days you can get stuff, you know, you can Google certain people, although if you try to Google Menashe Skolnick or Jackie Miles, you'll basically get nothing. Or even Georgie Jessel, who was incredibly famous in his day, but there's hardly anything there on him. So
the Jack Benny is interesting. I gather he's wearing bifocals, if I'm looking at this correctly. But also, he's not in one of his usual poses. You know, he's not holding his hand out like he's just, you know, hit his punchline or something. And he's different. It strikes me that your illustration of him is quite different from the illustration of pretty much anyone else. It's a very relaxed. He's not, he's not smiling. He's looking kind of off. It's really interesting looking.
One of the things I wanted to do in this book is to one of the reasons I don't include text is because I want each illustration to sort of tell a little story, and some more than others. And the Jack Benny one in particular is Jack at the height of his career, at the end of his career, but he's like, he had an incredible career. He was incredibly famous, successful, was really funny, was successful on Broadway, in movies, television, radio. So I wanted to show him relaxed in his Beverly Hills home. One of the great lines that I read recently was from Woody Allen in an interview in Vanity Fair, where he talked about visiting Jack Benny, and his comment was, yeah, Jack Benny was a real Beverly Hills Jew, and I just liked how that sounded. So I want to just present him in his Beverly Hills home, just relaxed, like he doesn't have anything more to prove. He's done it all, and he's just looking at the reader like just with a contented smile. And the fact that it's opposite, there's also the drawing of Mousie Garner in what might be an old age home, but he's got a an electric blanket wrapped around him, and he's sort of looking at the reader saying, what happened? You know, like, I've been in show business my entire career, and this is where I wound up.
Right.
So,
and so
it's sort of, you know, the opposite of, you know, Jack Benny just, like, had done it all, and there he is. And
it almost looks like a woman, actually.
Well, he wore his hair like that.
Yeah.
When he usually combed it, Mousy Garner, usually combed it back, but, you know, when he did his comedy act, his hair was like, he had crazy hair, so, and greasy, and he would let it fall to it. It was sort of like Shemp.
Now,
Shemp-like.
Will the second book have any old Jewish women comedians?
Yes. I had considered them for the first book. There's not that many.
Right.
You know, there were a lot of funny ones, but not that many that I couldn't really come up with too many. But the second one will have some, including Molly Picon, who was also incredibly popular in her day, mostly in the Yiddish theater, but then she branched out to television and Broadway shows. And also Phyllis Diller was Jewish, and she'll be in there. And then there's some other ones that are a little more obscure. And then there's other ones I'm still considering, like Joan Rivers, possibly, and Elaine May. And then some of them died kind of young, like Fanny Bryce died when she was in her early 60s, and Toadie Fields didn't live that long.
Right.
So, you know, they didn't quite, like Lenny Bruce won't be in any of these books because he died at age 40. So.
Now, Drew, you're best known for your caricatures, this type of work. What's the process for doing one in terms of what medium do you work in? What do you is there a signature in your mind in terms of the background or the expressions, or is there something, you know, beyond what we just see when you do one of these?
That's the Beagles in the background.
We'll get to the Beagles, I promise.
I think FedEx is pulling. But the process, it depends on whether it's an assignment, you know, of course, if I have to draw somebody specific. But my technique used to be what people call stipple style. I haven't done that in many years. But now it's, you know, I usually use watercolor. I work only with the brush. But I do a pretty tight pencil sketch before I paint. So the effect that you're seeing in the Jewish comedian book and my work, it begins with a tight pencil, and then I paint right on top of that, and I don't erase the pencil. So hopefully that'll just give it a richer look, which is what people seem to pick up on, the intense detail. But if it's an assignment, you know, the best, if it's a magazine assignment, if they tell me exactly what they want, you know, that's the easiest way. But if it's up to me, then, you know, I have to kick around some ideas and submit some sketches. But with this book, the Jewish comedian book, I mean, I first came up with a list of people I wanted to do, and then, you know, as I got to each person, I would figure out how I wanted to present them. Some of them are just up close, like faces in your face. I wanted the effect to be like these guys are just staring right back at you in your face. And then I pulled back on some of the other ones and wanted to show them in an environment like the Jack Benny one, or Mousy Garner, or a few other ones.
You did the cover for the first tabloid edition of the New York Observer a couple weeks ago.
Right.
And which I thought was great. And it was interesting because here they are going to this, you know, smaller tabloid format from the full page, and there's even more focus on the art. Anything particular about what you were asked to do with I think it was Hillary Clinton.
I did the first one, and the editor just asked me to, like, make sure there was a head that they could pull off and use on the front cover. Right now, the full illustration of Hillary Clinton posed as Michael Corleone, which ran with an article about how Hillary's people are very, like, secretive about things. So I wanted to, you know, that was the concept, to show her as, you know, Mike Corleone. Like, I didn't even read the article. The editor, you know, when I work with them, the editor will give me a couple of lines of what the gist of the piece is about. So that's what I went on. But the only specific thing he asked for was that there would be a face they could pull, since they have this new format where the cover is just an image, is a portion of the artwork, and then you turn the page and there's the full illustrations on the on the second page, the third page, you know. So
that right, they have that outer jacket to the paper now.
Yeah, they completely revamped the thing. Just to, you know, everybody shrinking down in size, the Wall Street Journal just did, and everybody sort of reshuffling things. The New Republic is debuting next week with an entirely new format.
Do your personal politics affect what you draw and how?
Occasionally, if I'm asked to do a Bush, you know, it might be a little edgier or Cheney, but I try not to let it. You know, if it's a drawing of Hillary Clinton, I want the stuff to be as honest as, you know, as, I don't want to hold back, or I don't want to, like, be more vicious if I don't like somebody. I like to stay, you know, like, kind of neutral when I'm working on the political stuff. Occasionally I'll draw somebody I can't stand, but, you know, the art director and the editor don't have to know that.
Well, I was going to ask you if you've refused assignments that didn't align with your own beliefs.
I don't think I'd do any cigarette ads, and I wouldn't do anything that would harm animals or children. I wouldn't do any PETA ads, but I also wouldn't do any ads for... It's a small list. I mean, I'm you know, like everybody, I'm a slight hypocrite. I'm a vegetarian, but I also do work for Field & Stream magazine occasionally. And I mean, that maybe that's the extent of it. That don't tell my mother that I've done work for Field & Stream. But
really, what would your mother say about that?
Well, she's also a militant vegetarian. I'm not a militant vegetarian. I wear leather and I just don't eat meat, you know, only because it does, mainly because I love animals, but it doesn't agree with my stomach. So, but I do wear leather and I wear leather shoes. So, you know, but I also do work for Field & Stream occasionally.
Have you ever given any thought to who you've drawn the most on assignment over the years?
No, I don't think so. But I'm guessing it could be Woody Allen. It's quite possible, or Howard Stern. I love drawing comedians. Young and old, and Jewish comedians, and old ones. So that's why I did that book. The editor of the book, Monty Beauchamp, came to me and said, "Would you like to do one of these books?" Because it's part of a series that he's doing, Blab Storybooks, and he's got other artists who've done them, Sue Coe and Gary Baseman, and a few other people. So I said, "Yeah, that would be fun, just to work on it while, between assignments, like over a year, you know. So what would I most like to draw, you know, just to relax and unwind?" And, you know, old Jewish comedians was it. So I didn't go to him and say I'd like to do a book about old Jewish comedians. He came to me and said, "Do you want to do a book?" And then I had to think about what I would most like to draw over a period of, you know. Of course, the problem now is, like, so what are you going to do? I'm doing the sequel, more old Jewish comedians, but people have said, so next you're going to do young Jewish comedians, right? Or middle-aged Jewish comedians, or, you know, or Jewish old Jewish chiropractors, stuff like that. So I've been making it clear that I'm out of the old Jew business after the sequel left. Also out of the Jewish comedian book, Jewish comedian business altogether.
I don't know. You know, you mentioned Howard Stern. I would think he's going to want to, you know, get in on this.
Well, he gave me some nice quotes for the book, but he's going to, I have in my next book that's coming out in the spring, The Fun Never Stops, which is an anthology of comic strips and illustrations. Howard appears a few times in that book.
Now, I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to ask you about that. As you compiled your work in that book, and that's June 2007, I think that comes out. Did you discover any common themes about your work from that period that maybe hadn't occurred to you until you had to organize it?
No, I don't think so. There's all different kinds of things in the book. The next book is an anthology of work mainly from the early 90s. My last book of comics was called Warts and All. It was co-written by my brother Josh.
Right.
That came out in 1990. So this is work that came out after that, and it, also it's the last of the stipple work that I did, which I phased out around 1995, only because I got tired of it. Mainly, you know, I just got sick and tired of it. I didn't need it anymore, and I was slowly phasing it out. And sure enough, when I did my last drawing with some stipple in it, and then the next drawing with no stipple, nobody mentioned a thing, because I was, you know, just quietly phasing it out. But that's mainly the theme, that it's the last of the work with that drawn in that style. But there's a lot of show business stuff, a lot of stuff from Entertainment Weekly, and also a lot of the beginning of the political stuff that I would start doing. You know, like, I don't know if people are going to remember that there was another guy named Bush as president, but he popped up in this book.
And
Clinton, and you know. But it's not. It's mostly illustration work and comics from the early to mid 90s, and then all the other comics I've done up until, you know, recently. There was a piece I did called "Guilty Pleasures of Literary Greats" that also ran in the first issue of the new New York Observer a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that comic, which I just completed 2 months ago, will be in the new book as well.
Okay. Now, Drew, you work for two of our most famous and, for that matter, infamous humor institutions, the National Lampoon and Spy.
You're not including MAD?
I forgot about MAD. I'm sorry. And MAD. Let's throw them in. Do you have any good stories about assignments from any of those three?
National Lampoon was nothing really from National Lampoon. It was basically, you know, we do comics and give them, you know, it was hard to get in there at first, and that's why I wound up doing stuff for Heavy Metal, which was in the same, which was downstairs from them. They were owned by the same people. But they, at first, when in the early 80s, they weren't, National Lampoon, they weren't being very receptive, so I just went to visit Julie Simmons, and I could hear her howling in her office looking at my stuff, and that was, you know, then she gave me a regular gig for that. But the working for Spy was a lot of fun because they became so popular, and it was just, you know, it was great to be in there while they were going through that period where just like they were the magazine, everybody was talking about it, and it was just a fun thing to be involved in. But then, you know, they went downhill just as quickly. So
that
wasn't so much fun.
The early part, that would be from the book, The Spy, The Funny Years, right?
Yeah, like from like 86 to 91, 92. And then after that, I worked there till around 93, and that was it.
Now, the last time we spoke, you had mentioned to me about a book that you were illustrating for Maddie Simmons. Is that still on?
It's still up in the air. I think that Maddie's daughter, Julie, is still trying to sell it to a publisher, so that's where we left off on that.
Okay. And we'll wrap up in a minute or two, but I'm curious, you come from a creative family, of course, so your brother Josh is a writer, a musician, I think even tried his hand at film. Your dad, Bruce J. Friedman, best-selling author, scriptwriter, and you know this, but I'm going to throw this in for people who are listening, he wrote The Dick and The Lonely Guy for print and Stir Crazy, Splash, and The Heartbreak Kid for screen. I'm thinking that when the family gets together, that must be kind of a tough audience.
Especially around my father, because he sort of is in charge. I mean, as far as being the funny guy, you know, it's hard to get him to laugh if you're one of his sons. But he appreciates, you know, my work and my brother's work and he's a tough audience. It's hard to get him to, like, you know, to howl with laughter. It's rare.
Is he funny?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So
always funny.
And
like anything, you know, it just comes out funny. So he's always, and usually he's on too.
Did you know? It's funny. We just introduced Splash to my daughter this very week, just by coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
Did your dad's career did it influence your own choices?
I guess it did. I wasn't really aware of it. I mean, it must have, because he in the early 60s he worked at a company called Magazine Management, which was the company that owned Marvel Comics. So
right.
The next office to him was Stan Lee. And these were the lean years for Marvel, when Stan Lee was down to one secretary and then, you know, a couple of artists that would do the work. But they were the guy who ran the company, Martin Goodman, was Stan Lee's cousin, I think. Cousin, uncle.
Uncle, I think.
Uncle, right. But I think he was, you know, he really wanted to phase the comics out. You know, of course, right after, you know, that was just right before they exploded and became the biggest thing. But my father would bring home piles of comic books, piles of Marvel comic books to us, like, every week. So it was just like, but we took it for granted. We just assumed, okay, everybody's father brought home piles of comic books from their office every, you know, every day or every week. So it was sort of like he was bringing us this stuff as a little kid, so we just couldn't avoid it, including and Mad Magazine and Famous Monsters Magazine and all that stuff. So. But especially the comic books. So, you know, it was sort of being shoved in my face, whether I wanted it or not. And I wasn't even a big Marvel fan. I like you know, I like DC Comics also, and I liked humor stuff especially Mad. But everything, you know, little by little, I just started loving, you know, all of it, even Archie Comics.
Did,
as I got older, I got a little more particular about what I preferred. I gravitated more towards the underground comics and National Lampoon and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we started today, we were talking about, you think you know people because of their work, and then you mentioned something that you and your wife are involved in. I wanted to give you a minute to talk about that. You guys raised beagles.
Yeah, we have 3 champion beagles. We've had more in the past, and now we have 3. And, yeah, that's something that, you know, people usually don't know.
How important are the beagles to you in terms of, you know, keeping a rounded life? I mean, a lot of artists or even writers you hear about, they're so focused on what they do that you never hear about them having any other interests because they're so intense on their career.
Yeah. I think we don't have kids, but... the beagles, we center on them every day. So to me, the beagles are more important than just about anything, aside from my wife. The work comes third for me. My wife and the beagles come first and second. So I think that's good because I don't want to be so self-obsessed with what I'm doing. It's just, you know, I have a policy of quitting every day at 5, no matter what. You know, I never do all night deadlines anymore. I used to when I was younger, but can't do that anymore. But it keeps me more grounded in reality and, you know, what's more important. And I also want to mention that my wife just reminded me that we had the number one beagle in 3 years ago. We owned the number one beagle. He didn't live here, but we owned him. So that was exciting.
Now, will your number 2 and number 3 interests ever cross? Will we see a beagle book at some point?
I've drawn beagles. I've drawn, if you look carefully, you'll see beagles pop up in my work over the years.
Huh.
My Nina.
I was just going to ask you if that was your Al Hirschfield.
That's my Nina.
I see.
You'll see a beagle pop up. You know.
Very
I've
good.
I've drawn beagles about 10 times, including on the cover of the New York Times. Arts and Leisure section. One of our beagles popped up. So
now I'm sure we'll set off a mad search for those beagles.
Please do, yeah.
Drew, thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media this week. Folks, if you'd like to keep up with Mr. Media's Friday interviews, you can subscribe to the site via email at www.mrmedia.com. You can also subscribe to the audio feed in the podcast section of iTunes. Thanks for joining us.